TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk on Jenin. The refugees in the Jenin camp near the center of the town of Jenin in occupied Palestine are able to see their former homes across the border of what is now the State of Israel. In April of 2002, the camp made world history. After 12 days of shelling and bulldozing by the Israeli army, large parts of the camp were turned to rubble. Did Israeli bulldozers destroy buildings while people were trapped inside? What occurred here while the media and foreign observers were excluded at gunpoint? Robert Fisk tells the story. As war and Middle East correspondent for the London-based Independent, Fisk has shown both personal and political courage. His coverage of the war in Lebanon, the Israel-Palestine conflict, the Iranian Revolution, the war in Afghanistan, the Gulf, and Yugoslavia has often incurred the wrath of governments whose policies he exposes. Robert Fisk spoke in a church in Berkeley, California, in June of 2002. He received a standing ovation simply for appearing on the podium. This warm welcome led him to begin with the following words. Robert Fisk.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the risk of making myself immediately very unpopular with you, and please forgive me if this seems unfair, I've lived for 26 years in the Middle East now, and all the time I watch a tragedy, and in particular at the moment, not just in Palestine, but in Israel too, a tragedy continues. A few hours ago, according to a phone call I got from Jerusalem recently, an Israeli woman, a settler, and her two children were killed by Palestinian gunmen. They too have souls. They too are human beings, just like the people of Palestine. It worries me a little bit, and I thank you for your warm Berkeley welcome, that sometimes at lectures in the States and elsewhere, there's just a bit too much cheering and a bit too much pleasure. It's a tragedy for Palestinians and Israelis. Ladies and gentlemen, there was no massacre. Say it again, there was no massacre. Benjamin Netanyahu roared these words at a pro-Israeli rally in London's Trafalgar Square. As my Independent colleague in Jerusalem, Phil Reeves, wrote last April, the Palestinian leadership instantly and without proof declared that a massacre had occurred in Jenin in which as many as 500 died. I continue to quote him, Palestinian human rights groups made matters worse by churning out wild and clearly untrue stories. And of course, right up to this day, the story of Israel's massive, brutal incursion into Jenin has focused not upon what actually did happen in that terrible episode of Palestinian and Israeli history, but upon the supposed lie of the massacre. It is the lie, not what actually happened, which became the story. When the Israeli army on the 3rd of April went into Jenin, a center of suicide bombers, indeed I've several times interviewed the families of dead suicide bombers in Jenin and the surrounding villages, it was part of what Ariel Sharon liked to call Operation Defensive Wall. The fact that the Israeli operation failed, that suicide bombers still emerged from the ruins of Jenin and other Palestinian towns, the fact that only weeks after this supposedly brilliant military operation, the wicked bombers are still striking Israel almost daily, has been ignored. The fact that the Israelis refused all journalists access to Jenin during the battles and killings there, this too has been forgotten. So too have the Israeli army's own statements at the start of the bloodbath, an operation in which 23 Israeli soldiers were also killed. First, the Israeli army said it thought there were about 100 dead. The Israeli army said this, not the Palestinians. Then it said, I'm going to quote the Israeli army spokesman, that there were hundreds of dead and wounded. This is Israeli military sources. Then they said that there was a plan to move bodies out of the camp and bury them in a, quote, special cemetery. All this, ladies and gentlemen, came from the Israeli army, not from the Palestinians or humanitarian workers. Later, always late, the Palestinians, when they want to make statements, the Palestinians said it was 500, which is ridiculous. All this time, as I say, journalists were forbidden, along with humanitarian workers, from entering the camp. The Israelis claimed the International Red Cross was allowed to enter, but that they, the International Red Cross, chose not to do so. The Red Cross said this was untrue. The Israelis then claimed they had a video of Red Cross officials declining the Israeli offer. We demanded to see this video, and it couldn't be found, of course. When we listened to an Israeli army spokesman, Major Rafi Lederman, a brigade chief of staff, at a press conference, he said that Israeli armed forces did not fire missiles from American-made Cobra helicopters in Jenin. Like the original claim of hundreds of dead and wounded from the Israelis, this was totally untrue. The ruins of Jenin, when journalists did eventually enter, were littered with parts of air-to-ground missiles, made in the United States, of course, and Western defense attachés, who also went visited the scene, said that the Israelis were not telling the truth about the Cobra gunships. When the UN Security Council, including your very own United States, voted to send a committee of inquiry to Jenin, as you know, Ariel Sharon declined them permission to come. The Israeli army issued a photograph taken from the air showing what appeared to be a portion of the Jenin camp, which they said was just 100 square meters of destruction. My colleagues and I used computers to enlarge this photograph, and they took it to Jenin and pasted it out. The reality is it is 20 times 100 square feet that was destroyed, and that's what the picture actually shows, though it's not what the caption said. But let's take a closer look at Jenin. My own newspaper, The Independent of London, carried out a long and penetrating investigation of the killings there, including those of the Israeli soldiers. My colleagues, Justin Hugler and Phil Reeves, who is our Jerusalem correspondent, spent days in the wreckage of the camp. They did not describe it as a massacre, but they concluded that nearly half the Palestinian dead, around 55 or 56, were civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. Individual atrocities occurred, The Independent concluded, atrocities which Israel was trying to hide, as they put it, by launching a massive propaganda drive. Let me quote, if I may, from just three sections of the evidence in the Hugler-Reeves report. Israeli troops shot dead a Palestinian nurse as she tried to help a wounded man. Hani Rumeli, a 19-year-old civilian, had been shot as he tried to look out of his front door. Fadwa Jama, a nurse staying with her sister in a house nearby, heard Hani's screaming and came to help. Her sister, Rufaida Damaj, who also ran to help, was wounded but survived. From her bed in Jenin Hospital, she told what happened. "We were woken at 3:30 in the morning by a big explosion," she said. "I heard that one guy was wounded outside our house, so my sister and I went to do our duty and to help the guy and give him first aid. There were some guys from the resistance," terrorists for Israelis, of course, "outside, and we had to ask them before we moved anywhere. I told them that my sister was a nurse. I asked them to let us go to the wounded. Before I had finished talking to these guys, the Israelis started shooting. I got a bullet in my leg, and I fell down and broke my knee. My sister tried to come and help me. I told her, 'I'm wounded.' She said, 'I'm wounded too.' She had been shot in the side of her abdomen. Then they shot her again in the heart. I asked where she was wounded, but she didn't answer. She made a terrible sound and tried to breathe three times." Ms. Jama was wearing a white nurse's uniform, clearly marked with a red crescent, the emblem of Palestinian medical workers, when the soldiers shot her. Ms. Damaj said the soldiers could clearly see the women because they were standing under a bright light and could hear their cries for help because they were very near. As Ms. Damaj shouted to the Palestinian fighters to get help, the Israeli soldiers fired again. A second bullet went up through her leg into her chest. I continue with the second section. Jamal Fayed died after being buried alive in the rubble. His uncle, Sayed Fayed, told us that 37-year-old Jamal was mentally and physically disabled and could not walk. The family had already moved him from house to house to avoid the fighting. When Mr. Fayyad saw an Israeli bulldozer approaching the house where his nephew was, he ran to warn the driver, but the bulldozer ploughed into the wall of the house, which collapsed on Jamal. In a deserted road by the periphery of the refugee camp, my colleagues wrote, we found the flattened remains of a wheelchair. It had been utterly crushed, ironed flat as if in a carton. In the middle of the debris lay a broken white flag. Dura Hassan told us how his friend Kamal Zugaya was shot dead as he tried to wheel himself up the road. The Israeli tanks must have driven over the body because when Mr. Hassan found it, one leg and both arms were missing and the face had been ripped in two, he said. Mr. Zugaya was 58. He'd been shot and wounded in the first Palestinian Intifada. He could not walk and had no work. Mr. Hassan showed my colleagues the pitiful single room, as they put it, where his friend lived, the only furnishing a filthy mattress on the floor. Mr. Zugaya used to wheel himself in his chair to the petrol station where Mr. Hassan worked every day, because he was lonely. Mr. Hassan did his washing. It was he who put the white flag on Mr. Zugaya's wheelchair. After 4 p.m., I pushed him up the street as usual, said Mr. Hassan. Then I heard the tanks coming. There were 4 or 5. I heard shooting, and I thought they were just firing warning shots to tell him to move out of the middle of the road. It was not until the next morning that Mr. Hassan went to check what had happened. He found the flattened wheelchair in the road and Mr. Zagaya's mangled body some distance away in the grass. Now, I share the horror of my colleagues at these accounts. I have no doubt they're true. I saw the Israeli army's behavior in Lebanon in 1982, the use of phosphorus bombs and cluster bombs in civilian areas, the massive toll of civilian dead. More than 250 civilians were dying in the Israeli bombing of apartment blocks almost every day at the beginning of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in that year. Up to 1,700 Palestinians, as we know, were massacred. Yes, massacred by Israel and Israel's Lebanese allies in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camp that year, while Israeli soldiers who witnessed the killings but did not take part did nothing, as Israel's own Kahan Commission report makes clear. In all, 17,500 died in Lebanon that summer, more than 4 times the total dead in the International Crimes Against Humanity of September the 11th. Of course, Ariel Sharon, then Israeli Defense Minister, but then as now claiming he was carrying out a war on terror, has never expressed regret for this terrible death toll. But a few months earlier, in February of 1982, Syrian special forces razed the city of Hama and slightly outdid Sharon's later bloodbath by slaughtering up to 20,000 people when they put down an Islamic uprising. Hafez al-Assad, then the president of Syria, just as Sharon does today, claimed he was fighting a war against terror. He too, Hafez al-Assad, never expressed the slightest regret for this terrible death toll. So when, I wonder, does a bloodbath become an atrocity? When does an atrocity become a massacre? How big does a massacre have to be before it qualifies as a genocide? How many dead before a genocide turns into a Holocaust? These are not idle or cynical questions. Let me show you why. Not long after Sharon's failed operation to protect the citizens of Israel from the suicide bombers of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the so-called Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Islamic Jihad gunmen broke into an illegal Jewish settlement built on occupied Arab land at Adora on the Palestinian West Bank. Children were gunned down in their bedrooms. 5-year-old Danielle Sheffi was shot in her bedroom along with her mother and 2 brothers. Danielle was killed. Her mother survived. Up the road, Katya Greenberg and her husband Vladimir were sprayed with bullets as they lay in bed. In the little girl's bedroom, there were smears of blood and 3 bullet holes just above Danielle's bed. Her mother had been shot when she ran to protect her daughter. In all, 4 Israelis, including 2 armed settlers who fought back, were dead and 8 wounded. Now, you would have to have a heart of stone not to be moved by the terrible fate of Danielle Sheffi. She was only 5. But if at least 2 dozen Palestinian civilians dead in Jenin was not a massacre, how should we describe the 4 Israelis dead at the Adora settlement? Well, here is the official statement of the Israeli army's spokesman, Major Avner Fuchsman. I quote, "For me," he said, "now I know what a massacre is. This is a massacre." The Canadian National Post referred to the Palestinian assault as being barbarous, a word the paper has never used about the Israeli killing of Palestinian civilians. Here's the headline of the paper's report. Now I know what is a massacre. I don't like the mathematics of all this. 4 dead Israelis, including 2 armed settlers, is a massacre. But 24 dead Palestinian civilians, including a nurse and a paraplegic killed in cold blood, is not a massacre. I'm obviously leaving aside here the 30 or so Palestinian armed men, gunmen, who were also killed in Jenin. What does this mean? What does it tell us about journalism, about my profession? The words with which I began my talk to you today now sound a little bit different, don't they? Does the definition of a bloodbath now depend on the religion or the race of the civilian dead to be qualified as a massacre? Listen again to those words. There was no massacre. Really? And if I accept that the murder of a little girl and another civilian on a settlement is a massacre, is a ruthless and brutal killing, which I do, my goodness, so were the civilian dead of Jenin. Now, the Middle East, as the cliche goes, is a tough piece of real estate. The war between Israelis and Palestinians is a vicious, ruthless conflict in which no quarter is given. Women die in childbirth at Israeli roadblocks. Palestinian snipers target Israeli children. Palestinians are still suffering 35 years of Israeli occupation. Israeli soldiers shoot at reporters and human rights campaigners. Palestinians set off horrific suicide bombs in pizzerias and nightclubs and buses and restaurants, blowing Israeli civilians to pieces. The death of 500 Israelis, appalling though that figure is still only a third the number of Palestinians killed in the same period. You wouldn't think it reading the New York Times. Israeli death squads murder Palestinians supposedly on their target list and do not even apologize when their missiles and tank shells allegedly aimed at Palestinian militants kill their families. Arabs have suffered under a ruthless Israeli occupation. Now Nathan Lewin, a prominent Washington attorney and Jewish communal leader, is calling for the execution of family members of suicide bombers. Here are his words. If executing some suicide bomber families saves the lives of even an equal number of potential civilian victims, the exchange is, I believe, ethically permissible. It is a policy born of necessity, the need to find a true deterrent when capital punishment is demonstrably ineffective. Forgetting for a moment the twisted logic of this rubbish, if capital punishment is ineffective, killing all the family will be ineffective too. It raises some interesting questions. Who chooses who is to die in the family of a suicide bomber? If the bomber has 3 kids, how many of them do you kill? The youngest, or the eldest, or the whole lot? Or would it be men only, or grandmothers, or just wives and older sisters? By asking these questions, I show you the obscene depths to which this terrible war has sunk. We should remember that prominent members of the Jewish community in the United States have heartily condemned Lewin's fantasies. And we should, I think, reflect that the Palestinian suicide bombers don't even bother to ask these questions. For the suicide bombers are executioners, the executioners of whole families, and the immolation of their own life, out of despair, yes, and in retaliation for the killings visited upon their people by the Israelis. The immolation of their own life does not, in my view, excuse the fact that they, in their last moments, must be able to see the Israeli child in the pram who will die with his mother, the Israeli family eating their pizzas on a hot Wednesday afternoon, the old folk celebrating a Jewish religious festival who will be his or her victims. As usual in such terrible conflicts, the innocent are so often the dead. The innocent are so often the good guys, while the bad guys survive to make propaganda. And we, the journalists, in the middle of this carnage, we want to please. We make up weasel words to avoid criticism. We allow the Israelis or their embassies abroad to malign us and abuse us when we try to tell the truth. Which is why much of our coverage has become neutered and emasculated, especially in this country. The vile lie that we are anti-Semitic when we criticize Israel's often indisciplined and violent army has now received an excellent layer of dishonesty. We may not be anti-Semitic, these critics say. I like the may bit. But merely by reporting Israeli critically, they say, we are encouraging anti-Semites to attack Jews in Europe, spray paint their doors, threaten their lives, smash up cemeteries and burn synagogues. In other words, not only are we journalists potentially anti-Semitic, if not actually so, now, if you believe the nonsense spoken about us, we're helping to set those synagogues on fire. I reject this garbage. But you don't have to look far beyond the mouse-like editorials and coverage of the Middle East in American newspapers, the cringing way in which reporters avoid any words which might offend the most powerful nation in the Middle East, to see how so many in my profession possess the desire to please. We can report a few facts. A Palestinian suicide bomber kills 19 Israelis on a bus. An Israeli soldier shoots 3 children in Gaza. But we must not ask why the Palestinian killed himself or herself. We must not ask what the Israeli soldier was doing in Gaza. Occupation is one word that has to be avoided, as we shall see. But let's look a little nearer to home for a moment. President Bush has, as we all know, had another vision. This time, it's a vision of a Palestinian state. Well, it was a vision of a Palestinian state. Let's go through the diary. Back last fall, when America wanted to keep the Arab world and the Muslim world silent while it bombed the poorest and most ruined Muslim country in the world, Afghanistan, George Bush very conveniently had this vision, a vision of a Palestinian state. Then it was forgotten for a few months, until Vice President Dick Cheney toured the Middle East to drum up Arab support for another war in Iraq. The Arabs, of course, tried to tell Cheney that there was already a rather dramatic little war going on in the region, just over there in Israel and Palestine. And what happened? George Bush had his Palestinian vision again, along with Secretary of State Colin Powell. Now, however, after 6 visits by Ariel Sharon, and after George Bush was totally ignored by the Israelis when he demanded an immediate end to the West Bank invasion and an end to the siege of Palestinian towns, the American president has had another vision, a rather scaled-down version of the earlier vision. Now he has a vision of an interim state. It is a sign of how obedient your American journalists are that not one United States newspaper has seen this for the preposterous notion it really is. The ideas of this US administration, however vacuous or simply laughable, are treated with an almost sacred quality by the media here. What on earth, for example, does interim mean? It reminds me of Madeleine Albright's wonderful notion that the Palestinians should be happy because they might get a sort of sovereignty, quote-unquote, over some areas of Arab East Jerusalem. Shukran jazilan, Mrs. Albright. So what does interim mean? What if I described you as an interim audience tonight? Will you be here at the end of the lecture? What if I'm an interim reporter? And there are a lot of people who would dearly love me to be. Maybe I'm just a part-time writer who might have to pack up and go home if things change. To quote my old friend Talal Salman, the editor of Beirut's As-Safir newspaper, we are talking interim, a provisional state on territory segmented like beehives, with every town, village, and refugee camp cut off by a wall of tanks and permanent and moving checkpoints, with everything under helicopter surveillance, with death squads monitoring intentions and dreams, targeting anyone they discover, determine, speculate, or suspect may have explosive materials in their blood. Ladies and gentlemen, a provisional state is an innovation no one has ever heard of before. It's a state unrelated to land or people. All other states are permanent. But the Palestinian state will be a stopgap, according to your president, and its role or existence can be ended in a day or a year if its usefulness comes to an end. It does not need defined territory. After all, it is only interim. Nor permanent institutions like an army, heaven forbid, nor the luxury of independence or sovereignty or an economy or outside relations. That is Israel's luxury. Why do we accept all this? I mean, as journalists, why do we accept listening to this and not pointing out the obvious? Why do we go along with it? Why don't the great American newspapers, I'm talking about circulation figures, not content, why don't the massive... powerful television conglomerates challenge this dishonest, craven policy that even now is being constructed in the White House. Why? I've spent 25 years in the Middle East trying to answer the whys, and in no part of the world is our reporting so flawed, so biased in favour of one country, Israel, and so consensual in its use of words. Indeed, the language of Middle East journalism has become so cowardly, so slippery, so deferential, so locked into the phrases used by the State Department, the President, US diplomats and Israeli officials, that our reporting has in many cases become incomprehensible. For an American readership unfamiliar with Middle East history or recent events, or American viewers who have no particular interest in the region, our reporting has reached such poverty of expression as to render any real understanding of the conflict impossible. And I suspect that was the intention. Such is the bizarre nature of our profession in the region at the moment that any talk like the one I'm giving today has to follow a kind of mantra. So here we go. So no one can say this isn't true. Yes, Saddam Hussein is a wicked, cruel tyrant who invaded Iran and then Kuwait. We rather wanted him to invade Iran, of course, but that bit's been forgotten. Yes, he used poison gas on the Kurds. His Iranian war cost up to 1 million lives. He has a hangman on 24-hour duty. Women are hanged on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Yasser Arafat, yes, I believe is a corrupt, vain little despot who allowed his 11 or 13 secret services to beat, torture, and occasionally kill Palestinian opponents. Many of them were trained by the CIA. I should add that I never could see why Israel wanted to negotiate with him, unless they saw him as a weak militia ally who could police the West Bank and Gaza on their behalf. Palestinian suicide bombings are a fearful, evil weapon, yes. But we are nevertheless lying about the Middle East because we are distorting the truth, either because we are afraid of criticism from Israel and its supporters, or because we journalists prefer an easy life, unencumbered by hate mail and letters to the editor.
That was the first part of a talk by Robert Fisk, war and Middle East correspondent for the London-based Independent. Next week you will hear the conclusion, which includes his comments on 9/11 and terrorism. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Robert Fisk and The Independent on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get a copy of the full 1.5-hour speech by Robert Fisk by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.